Hello and welcome to another CG Garage episode number 15, brought to you by Chaos Group. I'm doing this podcast out of my hotel room in San Jose. And the reason I'm in San Jose is because I am attending the GPU Technology Conference. We'll probably do another podcast about that more specifically. But what happened when I was here is I ran into Jeff Muddle. And Jeff Muddle has been an old friend of mine for a long time, and we always tend to run into each other at conferences. He runs a great website called CG Architect, which has been around for a long time. We talk about that. And while we're having lunch, we started talking about the strive for technology and that I feel that there's a gap between what the VFX people want in terms of new technology and what the architects want as well. Back when I was starting, we were always looking for new technology and architecture, and it doesn't seem to be there anymore as much as it used to be. So I'd love to know more from you guys about what you feel and where you'd like this technology to go. So please, after listening to the podcast, go ahead and send us an email, labs@chaosgroup.com, or leave a comment on the comment section so that you can share your thoughts with everyone else on this podcast. And then, or you can send us a tweet, which is @CG_labs, and let us know what you think. We also talk about a really cool conference that Jeff is starting, and he's doing a little bit differently. He's doing it with a Kickstarter project, which you may not necessarily know how that works, but it actually seems pretty interesting to me. So go ahead and towards the end of the podcast, we talk about that conference, the CG Architect Conference, and how it works and what it's about. And I think it's something really cool, and I'd really like to reach out to the community and let everyone know about it so that Jeff can try to get that thing going, because I think it would be a really great thing, especially in light of everything we talked about. So with that said, I'll let you guys go so that you guys can listen to the podcast. And that's it. Thanks, guys.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
So Jeff, how long have we known each other?
I was thinking about that. It's got to be a good, 10, 15 years? No more than 15, because CG Architect started in 2001.
Okay, so you started in 2001. You started 2000. That's actually the first time I talked to you. You literally cold called me at Gensler when I was working in Santa Monica at the time. So that must have been at least 2001.
Yeah. Well, CG Architect was started 2001.
So you called me. Yeah. You cold called me. He's like, I'm starting this website. And by the way, like a website about something was unusual at the time.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's back in the day. I mean, there was CG Society. Or no, CG Society wasn't even around. It was CG Channel back in the day.
There was one thing, yeah. Right? And he's like, I'm doing one thing about architects only. And I was like, huh. I remember that. That was a very different thing back then.
Yeah, I mean, there wasn't anything around, in terms of community. I mean, there was I think Autodesk had a forum for Max users, and I don't even think Lightscape back then even really had a community. I mean, that's the whole thing started because I was working in Lightscape, and there was really nowhere for us to be able to talk online.
So let's go back to that. So you were working in Lightscape, right? So that was your passion, and then you wanted to start a forum specifically for that to happen?
Yeah, well, Here's a little inside story that probably not many people actually know, the reason I started CG Architect.
Okay.
I had been working at the time at a company called SMED.
I forgot about SMED. Yeah.
So it was like a Hayworth or a Herman Miller Steelcase. We were visualizing, millions of dollars of furniture and floor systems and walls, you name it. And I think I was probably with them for maybe 5 or 6 years at the time, and I thought, I'm kind of getting bored of this. What's the next thing? I thought back then, maybe there was like a couple dozen people in the world, little did I know, that were actually doing what we did. So I thought, well, you know what? I had this kind of brainstorm one day, actually in a movie theater while we were watching Shrek of all things. Uh-huh. And I thought, you know, I should start this website and I'll interview some of my Lightscape friends. And the most important part, though, was the job board. So when people posted the jobs, right, I would see them before everybody else. I'd be able to apply for the job. So that was the start of CG Architect. Obviously, it grew to something much bigger than I ever anticipated. But
I remember specifically you approached like, from my point of view, you approached me and was like, hey, you know, I know you work at Gensler and I'd like to get some involvement from you guys or participation. And I thought it was very interesting because you've always approached it like, I'm not just going to make it about my friends or everything else. You made it about like, I'm interested in the business of architecture, in what's actually going on for real people that are trying to get jobs and understand that, right?
Yeah, I mean, CG Architect was never started even with the remote idea of being a business. So it was always about community from the start.
It's about community, but you made community involved in the business, right? So in the sense that you came up to me from Gensler, not because I was part of the community. You came up to me as like, what is those guys at the big architecture firms doing so that my community can go there? As opposed to just being a bunch of, you know, free-for-all in a way. You had a very specific sense of helping people go in the right direction.
Yeah, I mean, once I got a sense of kind of how big our industry really was, I mean, it was quite small back in 2001, but when I got a sense that there was a lot more people doing this, I mean, I wanted to try to reach out to as many people as possible. And I think one of my first interviews was with Eric Hansen, who had worked on... Fifth Element.
Yep.
So, I mean, it was...
Also a Gensler graduate, actually.
Oh, is that right? I didn't realize that. So, yeah, I mean, I was even Henrik Juan Jensen, who had basically done the algorithm for subsurface scattering. He was one of my very first interviews as well. So I was reaching out in all sorts of different directions, just trying to, you know, see what I could do with it. Really.
It's probably how you how you found me, because I think Eric probably pointed you to me.
Yes, that's right. That is right.
You know what? It actually goes back to the point of, I keep joking with Gina. First of all, Gina is this point in my podcast where I always mention her name and she hates it. But I'm going to point out, because she always jokes about me being like the six degrees of separation from Kevin Bacon. And I am going to say that Eric Hansen actually has more connections in the industry than I do, because that's how I like anything I do that's remotely in a way back machine always comes back to Eric Hansen.
Yep.
And he's a really interesting cat about that kind of stuff, for sure.
He's a good guy.
Yeah, he's a good guy. Anyway, so back to that point is, so you started this website and it kind of blew up for you in a way. You were still had your day job, right? You were still working for SMED, right?
Yeah, I mean, I had quite a few jobs over the years while CG Architect was running in the background. I mean, it started with SMED, and then I went to go work for Smooth, which is now Assembly Studios in the UK. Then I went to go work for ArcVision Vizmasters for a number of years.
And you were doing, you were like making big conferences and you were getting involved in some big events at that point, right?
Yeah, I mean, when I got to the Vizmaster side, when I was at the Smooth side, they had hired me to open up a North American office for Smooth at the time. Mm-hmm. So I was with them for about a couple years. And then at that point, I had moved over to Vizmasters. And yeah, I was in charge of running Vizmasters. So everything from the stores to the events. I mean, obviously, you know, all of us on the team participated in all sorts of different things, but that was my main role, running that stuff. And the Vizmasters DMVC was I think we did it for 3 or 4 years, that event. So
this all comes back to, for those who've been following the podcast for a while, this all comes back to SIGGRAPH 2007, which was my first Vizmasters conference. There was a Vizmasters conference that happened in San Diego right following SIGGRAPH that year. And that was a huge event for us. And I remember very specifically, you invited me to talk at that event, which was really interesting to me, because at that point, you got to think about it. I had left the architecture business in 2002-ish, about.
Yep.
So from 2002 to 2007, I had very little communication in the architecture community, except for going to forums, et cetera, or every now and then.
I think that's what interested me the most about you, is the fact that you had made that transition from architecture into visual effects. I mean, you were one of the very first people I knew that had done that.
Well, there's a lot of us in that field. Surprisingly, if you work in VFX, there's a whole lot of people with architecture degrees. So it's an interesting thing. But I was still interested in architecture and what had become of it, specifically in the architecture side, because what right after you invited me, or around the time that you invited me to go to that, I was starting to look into what's going on, and I said, it was more of that holy crap moment where I looked at the stuff that Neoscape was new at that time, or right. It was kind of a newish company, or coming out, and the other one with a U out of the UK.
Uniform.
Uniform. And they were fantastic work coming out of these companies, and they were like putting green screen elements. I mean, these are the unheard of, right? I mean, it's like, I'm still fighting with people back when I was there. It was like to move away from a walkthrough, and they're like putting green screen people in there, and, you know, actual score. They're putting together a real video, right? So suddenly I was like, oh my God, it's actually changing. Architectural visualization is actually becoming a story, as opposed to the architects had no idea how to tell a story.
Exactly.
And that was the thing, right? Because suddenly architects, they can actually, you know what? I'll take that back. Architects can tell a really great story in front of a board, right? They can sit there in front of a board and go, here's your space, and here's what can happen here, and here's what can do that. But they don't realize that what they're doing there is they're actually storyboarding an idea. And when someone actually writes that down, and they can actually turn that into a film, right? Which is what the companies like Neoscape do. And it wasn't until companies like Neoscape did that that they realized, oh my God, I'm making a movie about my space. So it was a really different way to think of architecture. And I was flabbergasted by it. But I remember, anyway, sorry, just I'm going my rant, but I'm going to keep going because I got to finish my thought. I presented that presentation, and I was just in awe about what was going on at that time. And I loved what was happening in that zone, and I thought it was really, really interesting. And I thought that finally architecture has, and architecture visualization has taken a point where they are cutting the grounds of visual effects. They've taken all the things they've learned about 3D and everything else, and they're now putting it out there and doing really high quality content. And people were looking at me like, oh, well, it's just a bridge for me to get into. That was the thing, right? It was, they're looking at me as like, oh, well, this is just a bridge for me to get into doing movies and doing visual effects.
Right.
And I was trying to talk them out of it. If you remember my presentation, I was like.
You were saying, you know, look, this is like a pretty thankless job. You're going to work insane hours. You think you're working insane hours now? Wait till you come to visual effects.
So, right. Yeah. And it was, it was not a very rewarding experience. So I actually thought it was a good thing for me to try to do that. And I remember specifically, who was it? Ernest was talking to me. And he was like, thanks for giving that presentation and talking people out of doing this. It was kind of a funny thing.
I still remember back in the day, I still to this day use this quote that you had said. You basically said, after you left Gensler and you went to go work, it was DD right after Gensler, you said you did more real architecture working at DD than you actually did working at Gensler.
I did. Because, just for comparison, I was a 3D guy in an architecture firm as opposed to being an architect in a 3D firm.
Right.
So I'm always going to be the guy who's going to be like, when I went to DD, it's like, well, we can get plenty of 3D guys, but someone who can actually design a building for us in a background, right. Chris is going to make it look realistic. So I actually got more chance to do that. And the best part of that is it doesn't matter because my building is going to get destroyed anyway. So so it's going to be just fine. It was really an interesting problem. So we've always kept in touch in some way or form, and I've always enjoyed hearing what was going on. And I didn't actually have an idea to do a podcast with you until today.
Yeah, we're sitting over lunch.
We're sitting over lunch, and I was complaining about the fact that I am trying to sit here and try to find something innovative to talk about with architects, and I'm having a hard time with that. And I don't exactly know what architects want anymore, and I realized how out of touch I've become with this subject. So when I was around, let's go back, 15 years ago or whatever it is, 13 years ago, I was always looking for the latest stuff. I was always looking for the latest technology. Yeah. And you were too. And you still are.
Yeah,
I'm not saying that you're not.
Yeah.
But I was always looking for the most interesting things. And I remember, like, as an example, saying, image-based lighting is going to revolutionize everything. And this, I said this back in 2002 to my guys at Gensler. Yeah. Like, yeah, all right. You know, it's, you know, just render things with a bunch of images. That's going to happen.
Right.
You know, you need spotlights. You need this and that. And you still need spotlights or IES lights or whatever. By the way, IES lights, VFX people never knew what those were until architects introduced them to them. But so that's true. But the fact is, we did revolutionize things back then. We were doing things, and architects led the charge. Architects actually revolutionized global illumination for everything in CG.
Well, Lightscape was the beginning of all
Lightscape
that.
Lightscape was the start. And then when it came to ray tracing, V-Ray made it accessible and simple for everyone to use.
That's right.
And I'm just going to plug my company right there. But there was a lot of companies that were doing during GI, and they were all pretty good solutions. But the only thing that made a difference with V-Ray is that it was super simple to use, and everyone used it. And that's why V-Ray became a big proponent in architecture. But architecture revolutionized global illumination for everyone, and I don't think people know that.
Yeah, I mean, I remember you telling me when you I can't remember if you were still at DD or maybe you'd gone on to Sony, but I remember you telling me that, you know, the work that was being done in visualization and architecture was actually higher end than what was being done in visual effects. Just
because, for sure, on the GI side, absolutely, and it's the architecture was revolutionizing that and still does, right? In my mind, I can't say still does, because I don't think architecture, and this is back to our original point, I don't think architecture has pushed technology that much anymore in terms of CG.
Yeah, I mean, you were talking about back in the day how we were kind of always seeking out the latest technology. I just don't think, other than until the GPU came, and, you know, even that's been pretty slow to advance, there really hasn't been any major changes that have happened. It's not like, you know, all of a sudden GI was coming out and that was the big thing, and then people were, you know, photoreal, that was the big thing, and, you know, then all of a sudden it was about storytelling because we had got to where as far as GI could go and stuff. So we're not seeing those big leaps and bounds as we were. I mean, it's only been the last couple of years.
But why aren't you? Because I'm seeing them. I mean, I'm seeing GPU rendering. We're here in San Jose. We're at the GTC conference. I'm seeing things rendered in seconds that would take hours.
It's only been the last, I mean, so here we are. I mean, I've been in the industry, it'll be 20 years next year.
Right.
It's only been the last few years where I'm starting to see new stuff that's really kind of exciting me, at least. You know, having been in the industry for so long and seeing a lot of the evolution that's happened over 3D, takes a lot to, you know, surprise me or impress me. I mean, after a while, you just sort of, it's all kind of the iterations of the same thing. But the GPU, again, it's starting to get there. VR now, AR, all these sorts of things, you know.
So here's what I think is important, because you brought up three things right there in that sentence. You brought up GPU, VR, and AR.
Yeah.
And I think those are the big things that I'm interested in terms of the architect community.
Yeah. And even on the fringe, you could even get into 3D printing now.
3D printing.
Yeah.
Okay. 3D printing is very, very interesting, because now you can just make something look right and then print it. You can even print it to color, right?
Yep.
You can do whatever you want.
Yep.
But why is it, right? I can go to an architect and say, you can do stuff in seconds. And they're like, why are they not interested in that?
That's a good question. I'm not entirely sure.
Do you think that, that's a good point. I mean, like, why aren't they saying, like, it's good enough? Do you think they've reached a plateau where, like, we've achieved photorealism, we've gotten everything we need to do, and it's good enough?
So it's true. I mean, the photorealism has got to a point where, you know, now it's to the point where we're splitting atoms over the increments of quality that we're getting now. It's so small. And I would hazard a guess that 80% of the clients out there wouldn't know the difference between a 2 out of 10 image and a 10 out of 10 image. So
right.
The ability to have, you know, do that extra post-production and stuff is lost on many clients.
Okay.
And that's, I think, you know, the D-boxes and the mirrors and the Neoscapes of the world, they've got clients who can appreciate. I mean, they do more than just images. They're more than just providing a commodity of delivering an image. They're providing a whole suite of services around marketing a building and and real estate. But those who are just doing, are, you know, the client's only interested in an image. That's all they care about.
Right.
I think it's getting less important for those people, and those clients don't care as much. I mean, the quality is good enough, right?
Right. So they've solved the problem. Let's just say, this is a weird thing to say, but we've solved photorealism in architecture. A
long time ago. Long
we've
time
solved
ago.
It. Yeah. So we don't even have to think about it anymore.
No. I mean, I think the... what's interesting now, especially with GPU, and whether it's the GPU or the CPU or some hybrid thereof, I think that's the less important part. I don't think the technology per se is the important part. I think what's important is the fact that the technology is getting to the point now where rendering within my estimation, within 5 to 10 years, will not be a thing. You don't render. You just... visualize. It just, your viewport is as fast as yours. So now it's all about iteration and design and composition. And
but we
it's
have
like
that,
virtual photography.
But we have that now. We have that now, and I don't find anyone in our architecture point of view taking advantage of it.
Yeah.
I have no one using GPU technology as an example.
I don't think we're close. I think we're close. I don't think we're there.
Do you think there's a price gap problem?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, right now, if you really want to, what we're talking about, you know, if I call it virtual photography. So if we can literally set up a scene and push a button and it's done, we're not there yet. I mean, you can get there if you throw money at it. I mean, for example, the NVIDIA VCAs, you know, if you want to throw $750,000 at it, you can get that.
That's not $700,000. It's
$50,000. For one. Yeah.
For one.
But to get that absolute, like, instantaneous result.
Right.
You know, it's you're up there. I think we need to get to the point where there are either services that are going to deliver cloud GPU or CPU, whatever it is, some sort of cloud rendering where it's a service where somebody can leverage that, or the hardware in the workstations is fast enough that its rendering is not a thing.
Okay, so this brings up a good point. All right, so one of the reasons I think that cloud rendering is having a hard time working is they keep approaching the wrong market. Okay. Now, let me hear me out on this. They keep trying to go and promote cloud rendering to feature films. And the reason it's failing in feature films is because MPAA still has this paranoia about stuff on the cloud and security.
Right.
Which, by the way, is not necessarily a problem.
Yeah.
If they approached the architects and they would actually be able to find out that these guys would totally use it as a service. Not only that, architects are used to using services like printing. They could bill it out to their clients just like printing. So your rendering could be billed out like printing.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's still some reluctance, you know, in every industry about the cloud. It's obviously getting less and less every year. It's becoming more commonplace. There's cloud services and people are getting more comfortable putting their information in the cloud. I think the biggest hurdle right now for cloud rendering in any form is the fact that almost all of these services are using Amazon or Google as their service provider to, you know, host all the clouds. And the way they're billing those is by the hour.
No, so not for Google.
I know, because they're coming down to the per minute, right?
Right.
But I think even if it's down to the minute, I think it's still a problem, because what happens is people start thinking about how much money they're spending every time they press render. If you're designing...
But this is a solvable problem. Don't you think architects have solved that when every time I hit print on my, you know, to make a blueprint, they're spending money just the same way?
No, not the same amount of money. I think it could be. Yeah, I think honestly the solution is, it's not that hard. I mean, they need to figure out what an average user will use and just figure out, you know, with laws of averages, and then, you know, set it up as a monthly or quarterly fee, and where it's unlimited rendering. They know they're going to win on some clients and lose on others.
That works and doesn't work. I think that if they just sort of test it out and work it out, they can work it. It's going to be a new paradigm for sure.
I mean, I've spoken to some of the companies that are delivering cloud rendering products, and that's been the feedback from their clients is they're
apprehensive to hit that button.
They're apprehensive to hit the button, and when they do, they don't know how they don't know how much money they're going to spend. Is this going to take, you know, an hour or 30 minutes? Or because even when you're leveraging GPU renders now, some stuff is incredibly fast. You render a car or something, and you know, it's the famous scene you always see at demos and stuff. That renders super fast. You try to render Taito Endo's Church of Light, you're still in it for hours. Anytime you have a ton of indirect light like that, it's still slow.
Use a light cache system like V-Ray that works inside of the cloud on GPU renders.
Yeah.
Just saying. But anyway, there are ways to do it. I just think that I'm not seeing. So basically, same idea, right? So you look at what the idea of pushing cloud computing in the architecture field. They're apprehensive to test that out. They're apprehensive to try it out. No one's taking the big leap, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think too that there's not a lot of systems. There's not a lot of software. I mean, people are using V-Ray, and I think we're almost there. I think people just have to wrap their head around what GPU is. I mean, it's surprising. You know, you talk to people that have been in the industry for 15, 20 years, and they don't completely understand really what GPU rendering means. I mean, even the veterans in this industry are still confused about that. So I think there's a little bit of it, still a learning curve around the difference between CPU and GPU and what those limitations are and kind of how they are evolving.
Right. So do you think, so you're saying that basically there's not a lot of architects out there that have ever bought a K6000 for, as an example?
Not for GPU rendering. I mean, there's certainly a handful out there, but you know, of the people I talked to, there's very, very few that have adopted GPU. I mean, there's an event I kind of host with some of the top visualization companies every year. We kind of tongue-in-cheek call it the Shadow Society.
Mm-hmm.
We met, I don't know, I guess a year and a half ago or so, and we specifically asked in that group how many people, you know, had used GPU rendering. And in that group, I think one or two out of about 30 people in the room, and these are, again, the top companies in the world, had said they actually used it. And then even then, it was only kind of for some brief tests. So I think there's still a little bit of an uphill climb we've got before we get massive adoption.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. And again, architecture always, I thought, led the charge in terms of certain technology and certain adaptation. And I used GI as an example. And I was hoping that they would lead a charge in two fields that I think are very interesting. And I'm not seeing it take place as much as I'd like to. Yeah. One is cloud rendering. I think that there's definitely something that they can do, and which includes GPU rendering. And two is VR. I think that architecture and VR should go hand in hand, like peanut butter and jelly. You know,
it's so like, on the cloud side, I think it needs to be to the point where it's invisible to the user. It doesn't need to be this big technical thing. I mean, you should press render, you see your frame buffer come up.
Right.
And whether it's rendering on your local server, your local workstation, or in the cloud, doesn't matter. It just intelligently figures that out, and it's you give it some parameters. I need it to render this fast or whatever. And that, I think when we get to that point, I think it'll be a lot easier for people to adopt. And when there's cost models that are easy for people to figure out. On the VR side, I would say that, you know, that's the one interesting part. You know, architects are traditionally very slow to adopt technology, always have been. Anecdotally, from all the people I've been speaking to, you know, over the last couple of years, now that Oculus is out, something like 50% of the major architectural firms out there have a DK1, have a DK2.
Okay, so let's talk about this for a second, because this is very much of an interest to me. I went to AIA last year, right? And again, exactly like you said, I'm being thrown back into the architecture mix, trying to understand what's going on. And obviously, I'm realizing that when I started, it was all geeky guys like me that were doing 3D work.
Sure.
Now, everyone's doing 3D work. You just like, it's just part of what happens when you graduate.
It's part of the design process.
It's part of the design process. Everyone's doing it. And they're doing it in SketchUp or whatever it takes. In fact, most of them are doing it in SketchUp. Most of the architects know SketchUp, and that is their 3D choice of to use to do their design process, because it's easy and it works, and it's not a technology barrier to go through to do that, right? And then on top of that, we offer V-Ray and SketchUp, which makes it very easy. Oh, yeah, I know V-Ray. Just it's part of SketchUp, whatever. But what's interesting is that also when I was at AIA last year, like you said, almost all of them had an Oculus because it was cheap and they could buy it, but they had no freaking idea what to do with it once they got it.
Well, even when you talk to the big visualization studios, they're still trying to work out what to do with it. And because it shouldn't – I've spoken, for example, Neoscape. I was interviewing one of their guys, and they specifically said, you know, look, we don't want to just adopt this technology for the sake of technology. It has to add something more to the equation.
Right.
Right? I mean, if it's just going to be used as a viewer – I mean, that's a complete waste, and it doesn't add anything. It needs to, you know, what else can we add on top of it? What other information can we layer on top of that information, on top of that virtual world when they're kind of looking around it to make it worthwhile? Because if they can't do that, then it's just not worth it.
Well, what I thought was interesting also was that a lot of people bought it, but they didn't know what to do with it, right?
Well, I think everybody got caught up in the hype. Of course, you know.
No, but they bought it, and it's like, oh, well, how do I put my architecture scene into this thing?
Right.
And then they realize, oh, I have to actually put it into Unity. Oh, I now I actually have to hire a sub-programmer. And these are people, like I said, they're SketchUp artists, right? Yeah. Like, oh, this is way beyond what I have the capability to do in my little, you know, 12-man architecture firm or whatever it is that I'm working with. I can't actually make this work. So it's a problem, and I think what I'd like to see is, like, why don't we make it easier for them to just go, I'll just do the same things I've always done and done that. Now, there are ways that you can do that. There are ways that you can just say render, and then that render information can work inside the Oculus. There are ways that can happen. I actually think what is interesting about VR, even from a static point of view, even from a, like you said, a viewer. You're just calling it a viewer. Let's call it for that.
Yeah.
But if you do it correctly, that viewer can offer way more than your traditional viewer can do.
Yeah. I mean, you need to add a layer of interaction, whether it's some sort of a device that you're, you know, with your, you know, there's a little cursor that you kind of move around. You hit a little cube or something that moves to another scene, or your overlay information when you click something or look at something specific in the scene. I mean, it needs to add more to the equation.
You need something that lets you hop around, right?
Yeah. Well, at a minimum, right?
At a minimum.
Yeah.
What about walk around?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think.
But now all of a sudden you have to get a person with an Oculus in a room that they're not going to bump at the furniture and walk around a virtual room.
And the architecture is resolved far enough that you actually want your client to be walking around into areas where you haven't actually figured out, right?
Right.
So, I mean, I think there's you obviously can programmatically stop them from going into certain areas that you haven't figured
out. But I think that there's, I mean, I'd love to hear what architects actually want to do in VR, what they think the potential is. So, I want to know what they're doing. I want to know what they think VR is about. And I don't want to know why they think VR isn't ready for architecture, or why they think I don't care about it. This is an important thing, because I want to know what is important to architects in terms of technology. Part of what I've been doing in labs is trying to push new technology. And obviously, I'm still have a bunch of people, VR people, and people working in VFX that are coming to me every day about trying to push boundaries of technology. And the discussion we had this afternoon was, I'm not getting that from architects. Architects have no desire, from what I've seen, to try to push the boundaries of technology in the same way, or they're not approaching me about doing that.
Yeah. I mean, I've had this conversation with, I think, Lon. We had this conversation too. I don't think that they're less willing to try to push the boundaries. Certainly, they're going to be more conservative than a visual effects company. That's their competitive edge. I mean, in visual effects, pushing the boundaries is how you surpass your competitors. In architecture, pushing the boundaries in technology, at least on the visualization and 3D side, I mean, that's not what it's all about. It just happens to be a tool in their arsenal. So I think, you know, they're not as motivated as VFX. That having been said, I do think that they're still very interested in exploring new technologies. I think that it's just they're not as vocal about it. You know, when I go to events, I mean, I spend 3 to 4 months of every year going to events. I mean, people are definitely thinking about all these things. It's, you know, they may not actively seek out the vendors to say, you know, hey, I wish it could do this, but I guarantee you, I hear it.
I definitely have had a few people that have come up to me about some really big ideas. And in fact, Kim has come up to me and mm-hmm. talked to me about stuff. And I've got to go through a mountain of emails that he has sent me about stuff that I have to get through. And I'm going to go through that, Kim. So if you're listening, sorry about the delay in there. But I'm going to get to it. But there is definitely some interest from a few key people. But I'm not – it's almost like I get an architect in our office and I show him some stuff they're doing on the VCA or whatever. They're like, oh, my God, I didn't even know that was possible.
Yeah.
It's like
– Well, I mean, because that's not their – you know, again, in a visual effects company, you have – a guy who's responsible for R&D. You know, their whole job is to seek out the latest technologies and how they can, you know, integrate that into their pipelines in architecture. I mean, you've got your visualization guy, and if he's got time and he's not being, you know, worked 18 hours a day to deliver stuff at the last minute, then maybe he's got some time to try to research what's new. I definitely find, too, as people get more senior in the industry, they tend to spend less and less time, you know, kind of within the community researching what's going on around them, and they're focusing more on the business and growing the business side of things. So
you think like the guys like you and I that are now in our 40 years or so are like saying, seen it, let's just keep moving on?
Yeah, like I said, I mean, it takes a lot to impress me now. You know, when I see a new technology, I'm like, yeah, okay, well, that's nice. We'll see where it goes and stuff. But the GPU stuff, you know, whether it's, again, like hybrid GPU, CPU, whatever it is, the ability to render in near real time, you know, however that's done, is interesting. The VR is interesting. The 3D printing is interesting.
Right.
That sort of stuff. It's all been around before. 3D printing's been around for 40 years.
All that stuff's been around.
I mean, I remember seeing VR 20 years ago when I entered the industry.
Right.
But it hasn't been, honestly, until the last couple of years where I'm starting to see it mature enough that, you know, we're literally on the cusp of something really huge, and especially on the ability to render in near real time. I think there's a lot of people in our industry whose business model is the fact that they know how to manipulate settings in a renderer. You know,
that's going to go away.
That's going to go away. So those people, I think, need to be thinking about 5-10 years from now, what happens when that goes away? What happens when it becomes virtual photography? I mean, if you don't have the ability to, you know, compose a shot and light a shot, I mean, there's always going to be room, of course, for the lower mid end.
Because I think that's the problem I have right now. Because I've been looking, going back into my architecture roots, right? And I've been looking at a lot of the architecture stuff that's going on. There's a lot of stuff that's out there, and you know, on your site or Behance or whatever, anything ArcVis site related, and beautiful renders, gorgeous lighting, and I'd say 75% of that frame is filled with stuff, material that was purchased on some site that has like flowers or a couch or whatever.
There's very
little actual architecture involved.
Yeah, I call those Evermotion specials. I mean, it's not a slight against Evermotion, but that's what it is.
But Evermotion is providing a good service, except that they're becoming the feature as opposed to what's actually doing. Evermotion is doing a great job. You need that because that's what a photographer would do.
Set dressing, right?
Staging a house when you're going to sell it, or whatever it is. But it's only about the flowers and whatever you're going to do.
Yeah.
And there's actually not that much attention being spent to actual composition and actual architecture.
Yeah. I mean, so, you know, obviously running CG Architect, I literally see tens of thousands of images every year. I think in the 3D Awards last year, we had around 4,000 submissions. I would honestly say in a year of seeing tens of thousands of images, I could probably count on one hand the number of images that I look at and go, wow, that's an exceptional image. Like,
or actually about architecture.
Yeah. Well, yeah. But even, you know, at the end of the day, you do these images to evoke an emotion, to tell a story, right?
Sure.
So a lot of them are impeccable. I mean, amazing detail and you know, really well lit, but they just, they're soulless. You know, there's nothing that really, you know, sucks me in and wants me to like really look at this image more. There's only a handful a year that I see that are really, really exceptional like that.
But what's amazing to me is if you take that back 10 years, let's take that back 10 years, 10,000 of those images would have been exceptional.
Yeah, well, obviously, as everybody kind of started to get from scanline rendering and three-point lighting to GI.
So I don't want to disparage the guys that are, like, you know, making those images, because every single one of those images would have been considered exceptional at the time.
For sure. Yeah.
But the fact is that technology has gotten to the point now where...
It's not about how real you can get it. It's now about it's a natural evolution, right? Now it's virtual. I keep saying going back to this. It's virtual photography.
Right.
You know, it's not about the technology crappy you use
CG,
to get there.
Crappy CG images in VFX or in architecture is actually rarer to find. Like something that looks like back in the 90s.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's what I mean. It's just like, you know, an architectural photographer. I mean, there's lots of those out there, but it doesn't mean just because you pulled the shutter doesn't mean that it's a good image.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Just because you can do, and it was funny because I said this in another podcast and someone picked up on it. I said, just because you can do good lighting and good shading doesn't mean you can actually pull off a good image. Yeah. You know, you have to be able to understand composition. And I would say, like, for anyone out there, just... Here you are now in the field of CG and or visualization, and what you've basically been given is a camera.
Yeah.
So if you want to learn how to make better images, then pick up a camera.
Yes.
And figure out how to do better images, because it's the same thing.
Yeah, I think the very best people that I see in our industry are those who are either exceptional photographers or artists, hand artists.
Right.
Because they know how to see light, they know how to compose a
shot. And then how to compose an image. Yeah, yeah. And if you don't necessarily know how to do that, then go out there and pick up a book from the 50s and 60s and look up architecture photography and look at what composition really is about.
Yeah. Well, it's like when DSLRs came out and everybody started shooting those. I mean, just because you have a $5,000 camera doesn't mean you're an amazing photographer. You can still take a bad photo with a $5,000 camera.
I can give my dad a Leica. He's not going to make a good photo.
That's right.
I mean, my dad's a great guy, but nonetheless. But yeah, you're right. I always use that as an example. It's like, it's just because I gave you a really good camera doesn't mean that suddenly you're going to pull the trigger and it's going to be amazing.
What I think is interesting, though, about this potential of having real-time rendering is, and I go back to the analogy of, you know, when we transitioned from film to digital photography, there were a lot of people that probably, when it was film and you had to make your own developments and everything else, that people just didn't bother to get involved with that. You know, it's still technical exercise. I think that same sort of thing is going to happen with visualization. People who previously, you know, they have an eye, you know, they're very talented, but they didn't want to be bothered with all the learning a rendering application and you know, everything that goes with it, all the technology that you have to know and networking and all that sort of stuff. So they just never got involved with it. I think when it gets to the point where it literally is virtual photography and you're dragging in libraries of materials that have all been measured and are physically accurate and you've got, you know, scenes and the models done, and now it's literally about, you know, the post-production, you know, obviously that's going to be a little bit an extra step. I think you're going to start to see people that were never involved previously. Okay. Now they are. Just like you're seeing entire sites that are dedicated to iPhone photography.
Right.
You know, those people probably never had a camera before, but now they're, you know, you can take some amazing shots just with an iPhone. You know, better than somebody who's got a $5,000 camera if you've got the eye.
Yeah. My friend Daniel has said, the best camera you have
is the one that's with you,
right? Yeah. So if you can get a shot on it, then you can get the shot on it. Yeah. So it's not necessarily that. And the fact is, it's the same thing with rendering, right? It's like, it's just having a bunch of features is not necessarily going to get you the better shot. As long as you figure out what you can do to make that shot work, that's going to work for you. And that's good. I mean, knowing how to use those features are always a good thing. You can manipulate things, but don't seek out rendering, seek out the idea of composition, seek out the idea of what you're trying to do. And like you said, you were calling them the EverMotion specials. It's like, I look at it and I take everything out of that room that's not peripheral and it's just a cube.
That's right.
That's right.
There's nothing in that actual room.
Yeah. You have some exceptionally modeled accessories, and that's what makes the image. But
the person never actually did anything in there. They just put all the accessories in that room,
yep.
and then they put a light through the window, and it's like, I made architecture. That is not architecture.
Yeah.
Sorry, that's I didn't want to bash on it, but it's kind of bullshit, you know? Like, I want to see some real architecture. I want to see something that's inspiring. I want to see some, you know, Raphael Maneo or Renzo Piano or Frank Gehry or whatever it is, that actually, like, something that manipulates light in an interesting way.
All of these architects created these buildings because, you know, they were trying to create an emotion or paint, sculpt something with light or using form. And, you know, you need to try to see, like, how can I visualize this in a way that, you know, speaks to what they were trying to accomplish with the architecture.
Yeah. I'll challenge anyone to basically take their beautiful render, remove all the furniture from that room, and do a render again and tell me how beautiful it actually looks.
Right. There you go.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And it's not about the bathroom tile or the faucet or the toilet or anything like that. It's like, just show me the room without any furniture, and I'd love to see what that looks like. And if you can do that, then you've got something special, you know? And compose it correctly too. So, yeah. All right. Well, I'd like to make this podcast about starting a discussion with architects and starting to understand what they're about. And if I'm going to say, hey, you know, I'll challenge you to whatever it is, what I want to challenge you to is to basically come in and tell me what you want to do, what inspires you, what involves you're in. And I think that, Jeff, you're a perfect vehicle to make that happen, to make me try to reach out to architects in some way. And I'd like to help you reach out to some architects as well, because I know you got something special planned coming up this year.
Yeah, so it kind of came out of nowhere here, kind of late last year. An opportunity came up to do another conference within visualization. I'd say I've seen more conferences kind of popping up around the world in the last 5 years than I've seen in the last 20.
Yeah.
But I had the opportunity to do one ourselves, and I wasn't sure if I wanted to get back into that game. Doing conferences is a pretty thankless.
I gotta tell you, the one I did, the Vizmasters 2007, was pretty awesome.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's fun to put them together. For the organizers, it's incredibly financially risky.
Yeah.
To pull off an event of 200 people, if you know, you can do an event many different ways. I personally love to do things, you know, at the highest possible level always.
Yes.
And that means it costs a little bit of money to put together, and as a result, you know, it's expensive. So rather than, you know, risk the entire business on running this next event, we decided to run it as a Kickstarter. So we have a Kickstarter running until the end of March.
And so what's involved in the Kickstarter? Tell me a little bit more about that.
So normally,
I think it's a good idea. Like, it's like, hey, do you want to get involved? Here's what it takes, et cetera.
Yeah, so normally when an organizer decides they want to run an event, they figure out the dates they want, they contact the venue, the hotel, and they just decide, okay, I need all this AV equipment, I need these food, I need room and everything. And the hotel says, sure, no problem, I'll book that room for you, sign right here on the dotted line, and you guarantee to give us, you know, $80,000 of food and beverage minimums and $124,000 worth of hotel rooms every night, and you sign here. And I know the organizers of pretty much every conference in 3D and architecture, and they all say everybody registers at the last minute. It was the same way when I did my own events. So here you are, you've signed on the dotted line, agreeing to spend $200,000, $100,000 of your own money, and you don't even know until 3 weeks before the event if you're actually going to, like, lose your shirt on it or not.
Right.
So that was really the impetus for the Kickstarter is, you know,
you wanted a guarantee.
Let's get the interest up.
So by doing a Kickstarter, you're saying, hey, you are going to pay now and try to make this event happen in a way.
Yeah. And so a lot of people, I was surprised actually, I guess I overestimated how many people knew about Kickstarter and kind of how that whole process worked. But basically, Kickstarter is a venue traditionally used for people that have a new product that they want to bring to market.
Yep.
And they try to seek funding. It's called micro funding.
Sure.
So they look for funding for their product. All they're looking is to just pay for their production costs, you know, the molds for developing their product or whatever.
Yep.
So we decided to basically use the same platform, but use it a little bit differently, I guess. So really what we've done is bundled everything in all-inclusive. You know, we've got 4 days of rooms at a hotel in Whistler, all the conference, all your meals except for breakfast, and you know all the cocktails and stuff that happen and networking afterwards, and put it all in one bundle.
And so, so here you go. Here's the cost of your ticket by putting in, like, it's basically you're going to Kickstarter. It's like you're buying a ticket.
Yeah.
And you're only going to buy the ticket if the conference actually happens.
Yeah. So we set a goal that we have to meet. You know, we set a $310,000 goal. It sounds like a ton of money, and that we must be like making off like bandits. That's actually for 200 people. You know, to do it at the caliber we want, that's the minimum we need to actually break even. We make absolutely zero. If you factor in the hundreds of hours we put in organizing, we'll lose money if you do it that way. So we set that goal, and then we set up all the packages for, you know, how many, which type of room you want and how many tickets you want.
Sure.
And so you say, yeah, I'm going to back the one for the deluxe room for the four nights and one ticket. And then if you back it, then okay, you're agreeing to pay that amount. You're not actually billed at the time. But when we hit our deadline on March 31st, if we hit or exceed our goal, then everybody's credit card is billed. If we don't meet it, then conference doesn't happen and nobody gets billed.
So you're basically saying, I will go to this event if it actually happens.
Right, right.
So it's really just buying a ticket for something that you would go to if it actually happened.
That's right.
There's the risk to you is either you don't go because the event didn't happen, or you do go and you have a ticket.
That's right. Yeah.
So it's really just kind of, it's not like you're funding this event in that way. It's like you're just literally buying a ticket through Kickstarter instead.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the only difference, and I think a lot of people are having a hard time wrapping their head around this too, is the fact that we've bundled everything together. Normally, a conference is like, you know, here's your conference ticket, and we've got some discounts at hotels. You're on your own for everything else, meals, everything. So, you know, you look at it and you go, okay, that's $250 for my ticket. Yeah, it's super cheap. But, you know, I spend 3 to 4 months of every year going to dozens of events. So I know exactly how much it costs. I mean, I spend $40,000, $50,000 a year just going to events and flying and all the travel.
Yeah.
So on average, I would say, and other people have told me the exact same thing, as long as you're not going to a domestic event in your backyard where it's super cheap to get to, you generally spend with your hotel, your flights, your food, your conference pass, about $3,000 or $4,000 to go to an event that's 2, 3, 4 days.
Yes.
So if you kind of break down the fees that we've got, it works out the same way. It's just that people aren't traditionally used to doing it that way, I guess.
Well, okay. That all sounds fine to me personally, because I, like you said, I've been to a bunch of events and I've done that, and it makes totally sense. And to me, it's like, it's a no brainer. It's like, yeah, this sounds like a great event. I'll pay now. And if it happens, then I've got a ticket and I'm all set.
Right.
And to you, it's a guarantee. Like, yes, I'm going to guarantee to have this amount of money, so I know that I'm not going to lose my shirt on the event.
Yep.
A lot of people have lost their shirts trying to organize events, which is why Jeff is doing it this way. It totally makes sense. So I like that idea. Now, what are you offering at this event? In light of the conversation we just had for the last 40 minutes.
Yeah. So, spending so much time at events, one of the most key things I run into is the networking. I mean, that I honestly register events now. I don't even look to see who's speaking. I go there because I know I'm going to network with people.
Right.
I mean, when I first started going to all these events, I used to, you know, plan. I had to meet these certain people. I had to like make these certain deals and stuff. And I gave up on that. More often than not, I would go to an event and I would meet somebody that I didn't expect to meet, and I'd have a conversation that I didn't think I would have. And then opportunities came out of that that I never anticipated. So, I built a whole business around networking. So I think there's huge opportunity. Even the events that I've organized where I've seen other people go, you know, whether you're, freelancer, or whether you're a owner of a big visualization company, I've seen people form partnerships. Even this shadow society that I was telling you about earlier, almost every single person in that room has worked together as a result of networking there. So, I mean, that's a huge component. So we're building a lot of stuff around the conference where there's tons of opportunity to network with people from all walks of life within the industry. The other part is, you know, we've brought in some of the most kick-ass speakers in the industry. I mean, seriously, there's never been an event with this many high caliber speakers, and we haven't even announced them all yet. So, I mean, that's the other kicker of this event. I mean,
Well, how big is the event going to be? What's your goal about the size of it?
You know, the Kickstarter, the absolute minimum, I think, is about 165 people.
So it's a pretty small event.
Well, if you compare it to a SIGGRAPH or something like that, for sure.
Yeah, I'm not saying that in a bad way. I'm actually saying that in a good way. I'm saying as a networking opportunity, yeah. because it's a small event, you have huge opportunity to network with some really high-end people in this industry.
Yeah, I would say the sweet spot for an event where you feel like you're part of something intimate is kind of in that 200 to 400 range. I mean, that sounds like a big number, but that's still small enough that you really feel like you're part of something kind of special, right?
Right.
You know, when you get to an event where you're in the thousands, I mean, if you don't know people, you just kind of wander around, you look at the sessions, and you go back to your hotel room, and you know, you have dinner in your room by yourself, sort of thing, unless you're with friends. So yeah, I mean, in a group that you know, relatively small, I think there's a lot of opportunity to network.
I think it's a really cool idea, and I think it'd be good. I'd love to find a way when the event happens, I would love to find a way to go back to those guys and ask these types of questions to them. At the same time that we've had in the past part of it, because to me, that's what I'm interested in. I'm interested in finding out what moves people and where it goes with people. And I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think people have asked that question to themselves enough these days.
Yeah, you know, I completely agree. I think there's far too many people in this industry that are, and I was guilty of this myself. You know, it took me probably a couple years after getting out of production to stop looking at the small little, like, oh, this new slider is coming out, or like, oh, look, there's a new button in this application I can use. You know, people are, you know, and rightly so. I mean, they're focused on their day-to-day job, but they don't have enough time to stop and look at the big picture. Like, where is our industry going in 5 and 10 years? How is that going to impact the business decisions I'm making today? And a lot of the sessions that we're going to be having at the event are going to be kind of centered around this. But I think that's a key point for sure.
Yeah, I'd like to sort of figure out what people actually think and send us comments and let us know I told Jeff that I'm going to start participating back on the CG Architect Forum because I haven't done that in years, and I should. So I will start paying attention more on that site. So because I used to actually be a moderator on that. So I will pay more attention to that. But either way, leave us comments or let us know, because I want to know what you guys think, and I want to know what drives you and what you'd like, you know, us to do in terms of Chaos Group Labs to really push technology. So it would be kind of an important thing for us. And so what's the name of your event?
CG Architect Conference, Visualization Conference. Simple, yeah.
CG, okay, so how do you find it on? Well, you can send me the link, but tell me the link right now over audio.
You can go to conference.cgarchitect.com, and that will give you all of the information about the event, and that links you over to the Kickstarter site as well. Or you can even go to Kickstarter and just search for CG Architect.
Okay, perfect. And then that way people can get what they need and they can put it out there. And when does the funding end?
March 31st.
March 31st. So I'm going to put this out on Monday, which is coming up. Today? Tuesday. So I'm going to put this out on Monday. And you guys will pretty much have 1 week to do this. So it's kind of like a thing to make sure you get that you call.
Yeah, if we don't reach our funding goal, the conference doesn't happen.
So. Doesn't happen. Yeah. Which is good. I mean, to be honest, it makes it a good safe bet for you, but I think it'd be really great for this conference to happen. So I definitely feel very, very strongly about it.
Yeah, even if we don't reach our funding goal, we still lose money, but you know, not as much money, I guess.
Not as much money. Yeah. Well, yeah, that still sounds bad.
Yeah.
So either way, I'd love to be able to support that and go back to my roots as an architect as well and find out, you know, what's going on with that side of the family. So and push it. And what's interest you? So let me know. All right. So we're just about where we need to be in the terms of the length of the podcast. I am going to say, Jeff, is there anything you want to talk about before we go?
I think we covered it
all. We covered everything?
Yeah.
Good. All right. We're going to let the last bucket drop, even though most of you architects should not be using buckets anymore. Should be using progressive rendering with the GPU and your VR headset. Come on, guys. Get with the times. All right. Thanks, guys. Bye.